often have major media outlets questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken or President Biden and said, how would you feel if your son or daughter was blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers? Why don't you insist that Israel stop bombing or all of the weapons will be cut off? These are basic, logical questions, but when they are avoided, then we're getting this sort of parody of journalism, which is more stenography than anything else.
That's Norman Solomon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Norman Solomon on war and the media. In times of war, the corporate media play a salient role in shaping public opinion. There are worthy and unworthy victims. They neatly divide certain categories. Muslims, Arabs, and Iranians generally fall into that latter category, whereas Washington and its allies are worthy victims who deserve our support and empathy. The current phase of the Gaza war did not begin on October 7th, as the media repeat ad nauseum. But to dig into the underlying causes and provide context and history rarely occurs because it would undermine the dominant propaganda. Thus, the Nora O'Donnells, Wolf Blitzers, Lester Holtz, and other corporate news anchors don't question the embedded assumptions and simply mimic, with few exceptions, the dominant official line. Our guest today is Norman Solomon. He's a political commentator and media critic. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of RootsAction.org, an online activist group. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. I talked with him on October 11th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, you wrote War Made Invisible before the Israeli attack on Gaza in response to the events of October 7th. And then you've crucially have added an afterword. Talk about the ingredients of that and how things have evolved.
I thought a lot when I was working on the afterword about the Gaza war. I tried to grasp how the events after October 7th, 2023, have related to the basic themes of the initial book. After all, the title War Made Invisible might at first, you know, seem counterintuitive because the Gaza war got tremendous and has gotten to some degree still a significant amount of U.S. media coverage. But it became really clear that the quantity of coverage didn't mean that the war itself has been visible. After all, the realities of war are death, maiming, terror, and very little of that has come through the news media coverage of the Gaza war, I think for two basic reasons. One is the inherent limitations of journalism to convey what it's really like to have missiles and bombs coming at you and the carnage and the death and the suffering, the loss, the mourning, the grief. Very difficult for TV, radio, newspapers, scrolling on a screen to convey to us what that's like, you know, to be in a war zone. But the invisibility has really been compounded by the tremendous media bias that we've gotten from mainstream U.S. media outlets. It doesn't mean that occasionally there aren't breakthrough stories that will shatter the invisible shield that separates us from the realities of war. But the essence of propaganda is repetition. The code words, the catchphrases, the frame of reference, and the silences. So the invisibility of what has been going on now into its second year in Gaza, I think has been a huge factor in insulating, in numbing people in the United States from what is being done really, if not explicitly in our names, certainly with our tax dollars and with U.S. government support. And then there's the subtitle of the book, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And at first glance, the U.S. military machine is not directly involved with what's been going on in Gaza. But if you go under the surface, really, the Pentagon and the Israeli military are pretty much joined at the hip. There are occasional disagreements, sometimes even at top level, U.S. president, Israeli prime minister. But underneath that is a tremendous synergy, ways in which really the Israeli military is functionally an adjunct to the U.S. war machine. And so that is also very much hidden from the U.S. public. The bombs and missiles that have been falling and continue to fall in Gaza and now also more recently in Lebanon, they are directly, in most cases, coming from the United States.
You write in the afterword that the extreme decimation in Gaza was foreshadowed from the outset. Explain what you mean.
Within the hours after October 7th, as the reporting came in, top Israeli officials said that we're going to shut down Gaza. No food, no medicine, nothing is going to get in. This was a magnification, a great acceleration of policy that has been in place for decades, where Israel has restricted what can go in, what can come out of Gaza, what's been called the largest open-air prison in the world. Some people say, well, not a great analogy since the people inside the open-air prison have done nothing really wrong. The vast majority of them simply civilians. In any case, in this instance, the gauntlet that was thrown down by Israeli leaders within hours of the news about the crimes of October 7th really did foreshadow what was coming up, because it was basically a declaration of war, primarily on the civilians. After all, the UN has documented that the deaths in Gaza because of the ongoing Israeli assault are overwhelmingly children and women. And it was an attitude from the Israeli government proclaimed that we simply will not have any compunction about decimating Gaza. And in fact, that's what has happened. The documentation is pretty clear now that certainly in this century, the speed and rate of slaughter of children and women in Gaza is unprecedented.
I don't like to use the term defense minister, but I guess I have to. The Israeli war minister, Yoav Gallant, said, "We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly." This is very interesting terminology. I mean, you might know that I have a background in, I'm Armenian and my family went through a genocide. And one of the key components of that Turkish genocide in 1915 was the dehumanization and the demonization of the Armenians. And they were called, all kinds of names, talked about in disparaging terms as animals, disease-ridden, etc. And it seems to be part and parcel of what happened. And again, the Germans did it during the Holocaust vis-a-vis Jews, Gypsies, communists, socialists, demonization and dehumanization, core ingredients of genocide.
David, as you made that, I think, very profound point about the objectification of people in order to rationalize genocide, I was thinking of a quote that actually begins War Made Invisible from Aldous Huxley, which he uttered and in an awful way foreshadowed what was to come in the following few years. Huxley said, "The propagandist's purpose is to make one set of people forget that certain other sets of people are human. And once that bridge is crossed, then all kinds of atrocities are possible." The very conceit that news media are conveying to us what war is really all about is part of the numbing process, because if we really believe that we understand what is going on, for instance, in Gaza, because we watch TV, listen to National Public Radio, whatever, through the mainstream media, then we're subjecting ourselves to a delusion that further insulates us from what war really is. And that makes supporting or at least accepting the war more possible.
You write in the afterword something about happened earlier this year. I'm quoting now. The United States cast the only vote in the UN Security Council against the resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, the third time that the U.S. voted to block such a resolution. It was, you continue, yet another move to serve as the main enabler for Israel's mass murder of Palestinian people. The cruelty and magnitude of the slaughter were abhorrent to anyone not somehow numb to the human agony. Such numbing has been widespread in the United States. Some factors, you write, include ethnocentric, racial, and religious biases against Arabs and Muslims. Talk about that a little bit.
The images come from Hollywood, from the language of mainstream pundits, from the imagery of news media, and also what's left out, the silences, the omissions, the lack of conveying the humanity of people, because at the one level, they simply are different than us, but more than that, they've been vilified through stereotypes and so forth. I have to say, when you look at the brilliant work of Edward Said over a period of many decades, how did people in the United States learn of what he had to say? Well, to a significant degree, it was if they listened to alternative radio. I mean, this is a radio program that has been able, willing to convey the voices of Edward Said, of Noam Chomsky, of others who, going back several decades, were willing to articulate on their basis of their scholarship and their humanity, how these stereotypes and cliches and really vicious characterizations of Arab Muslim people are completely absurd if they're measured up against our common humanity. And I think that today, especially younger people, are shedding that kind of delusionary separation between different people on the planet based on their usual ethnocentric divisions that are exploited, created, magnified by the news media and politics of the country. And it's very discouraging to me, but I think we do need to name it, that although younger people in this country have often, because of their access to other forms of communication about Gaza events through social media and online and so forth, have gotten increasingly wise to the cruelty and really the human disconnection that has dominated mass media and politics, when you go into the mass media and politics of the country, there has been only a very slow improvement in this status quo baseline that has really enabled Israel to continue to inflict ethnic cleansing on Palestinian people, now overt mass murder in Gaza, and by most definitions, genocide.
You write about, I'm quoting, the brawny arms of the Israel lobby. Talk about that. We hear the acronym APEC quite a bit, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the major U.S.-based pro-Israel lobby, which spent millions of dollars to defeat Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman. They were both running for the House of Representatives, seeking re-election, and they were defeated with millions of dollars from APEC to ensure that defeat.
APEC is really playing now in a huge way in the electoral arena. They didn't used to do it so overtly. And as you mentioned, both Jamal Bowman in Bronx and Westchester in New York, and then Cori Bush in St. Louis were defeated not by grassroots opposition in their districts, but by these huge quantities, many, many millions of dollars of advertising and attacks think parallel to those kind of electoral efforts are the 24/7, 365 efforts by outlets like ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which I think with Truth in Packaging should be called the Defamation League Against Palestinians, because that's what has been one of the main missions of ADL for a very long time. And it has cranked up since last spring. So many campuses went into upheaval in opposition to the continued U.S. government support for genocide against Palestinian people in Gaza, and demanding that their colleges sever any support or financial investments that are helping Israel to continue with its policies. And ADL and Aligned Forces really just went into overdrive, smearing the protesters as anti-Semitic, which of course is ironic given that so many leaders of those protests were Jewish themselves, as I happen to be. And so this is an effort to ratchet up the scam that has had tremendous propaganda impact in this country and has increased in terms of its intensity since October 7th, 2023, where the Israeli government perpetrating these ongoing crimes of occupation, of ethnic cleansing, now of really genocide in Gaza, that government wraps itself in Judaism. And then criticism of the actions of that government are then labeled and denounced as anti-Semitic. And I think it's notable that although there has been some pushback increasing from the grassroots and even in U.S. mass media on that technique, it still is dominant. It still is reflexive. And it has enormous salience, or at least impact, coming from mass media.
As you alluded to, among critics of Israel and U.S. Mideast policy are many Jews. You are Jewish, as are Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, Jeff Cohen, Naomi Klein, Medea Benjamin, Norman Finkelstein, and many others. The Jewish voice for peace on and off campus has been very prominent in protests and demonstrations. But that establishment-oriented organizations of American Jews have a much louder presence and influence. How to counteract that louder presence and influence?
Really, we have, I think, the necessity, certainly the opportunity, to say that we need a single standard of human rights. That's a basic question of human equality, and that we certainly shouldn't pick and choose and say, oh, now we have this precept of what human rights are and should be, and then we just cast it aside. We don't accept the Orwellian notion, the doublethink, that says that you take an idea and you take it off the shelf and utilize it only when it's convenient, and then you put it back on the shelf when it becomes inconvenient. The fact is that Israel has been and is more than ever an apartheid state. And there was a huge transformation in U.S. society during the last several decades, where acceptance of apartheid South Africa, largely because of protests and upheaval on college campuses and elsewhere in the 1980s, support for apartheid South Africa became unacceptable. And gradually, U.S. policy shifted out of necessity, because the facts on the ground, so to speak, became such that apartheid in South Africa became untenable. Reality is that Israel as an apartheid state gets away with it because in U.S. media and politics, overwhelmingly, it's not acknowledged to be an apartheid state. And yet the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they all have come out with unequivocal reports that Israel is an apartheid state.
You write, melding Israel with Judaism is a core distortion that enables defenders of Israeli actions to cry anti-Semitism. Explain.
It's really been, I think, in a macabre way, a brilliant strategy that has been in effect for so many decades, and especially after the foundation of Israel, Zionism became sometimes reluctantly by mainstream Jewish organizations in the U.S. seen to be necessary. There was substantial Jewish organized and unorganized Jewish opposition to Zionism, to the idea that Israel is necessary to have a quote-unquote Jewish state. But once it became a fait accompli, and then especially after the 1967 war, more and more the organized Jewish organizations with power in the U.S. basically became an adjunct to the Israeli propaganda machine. Recently, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to the United States and met with Jewish organizations, their leaderships, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, assured Netanyahu that ADL was committed to working very, very closely with the Israeli government to get its message out. And the message in all sorts of permutations is that Israel is the Jewish faith, and that if you are going to raise questions about Israel's behavior, its public policy, its military actions, that you somehow are falling into a trap of anti-Semitism. I write in the book about the cover story that Time magazine wrote just a few months after the Israeli assault began in Gaza. And it had a Jewish star filling the front cover. And keep in mind, this is the largest news weekly circulation in the United States. And the headline in the middle of the Jewish star was "The New Anti-Semitism." And this is, among other things, an assault on groups, including Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, led by Jews, saying that essentially criticism of Israel is an assault on Judaism itself. And so it gets, I want to say weird, but it's actually, from a propaganda standpoint, very logical, because it's worked in the past. It's seen as a winning combination of various messages sort of braided together. And so the net effect, for instance, with this huge cover story in Time magazine, was to tell the readers that because of the Holocaust, Jews running the Israeli government and Israel itself should get a pass, get out of jail card, so to speak. Whereas if you had the single standard of human rights and you apply it to Israel, then you would have to condemn the apartheid system. You'd need to condemn ethnic cleansing.
You know, there are some really good independent sources of information. I'm thinking right now of The Intercept, which somehow got its hands on an internal memo circulating at the New York Times, where journalists were to avoid using the terms, I'm quoting here, genocide, ethnic cleansing, refugee camps, occupied territory, and even further discouraging referring to Palestine as Palestine whatsoever. In addition, the memo claims that words like slaughter, massacre, and carnage are too emotional to describe Israel's bombardment of Gaza. What do you think of all of that?
That's really illuminating. And here's a very poignant fact in that context. When the Intercept news site did a rigorous study of the first 6 weeks of the Gaza war and looked at the content of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, they found that the word slaughter was used to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis. It was used 60 different times. And that same word, slaughter, was used only once in describing what Israel had done to Palestinian people. And then you go to the word massacre. In that six-week period, those three media outlets used the word massacre 125 times to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis, and used the word massacre a grand total of 2 times to describe what Israel was doing and had been doing to people in Gaza. And that even understates the disparity of regard for the humanity of Israelis versus Palestinians, because by that point, in the first 6 weeks, many more Palestinians had been killed than those had been killed, than Israelis had been killed by people in Hamas. So I think this is, if you will, a numerical quantification of the regard that these leading, very influential U.S. media outlets have for the humanity of Israelis compared to Palestinians. We really have a numerical, not only anecdotal, but empirical way to measure the inhumanity of our own major media outlets. And there is this sort of circular relationship between people in the White House and on Capitol Hill on the one hand, and media on the other, because the mainline media and the top politicians are walking, if not in lockstep, then in very close proximity. They take nods from each other. They are acutely aware of what is defined as the reasonable bounds of discussion. We have the disparity here that is so extreme that it amounts to the dehumanization of certain people. I describe it as two levels of grief, where conveyed overtly and more subtly, the suffering, the mourning, the sense of loss, the humanity of some people is conveyed very viscerally, very emotionally and empathetically for certain people, Americans, countries where designated allies of the United States are in charge. And then there's the flip side, the dehumanization. One contrast that I think in contemporary times is really simultaneous, and that is the U.S. media coverage of the suffering in Ukraine as a result of the really illegal and immoral Russian invasion and war on Ukraine. And there's been a tremendous quantity of human interest stories, of empathy, of outrage in terms of U.S. media coverage of what has been going on, the bombing of hospitals, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, the deaths and suffering in Ukraine. And when you contrast it to the equivocal kind of coverage that has been only occasional in terms of actually conveying the individual, the personal lives of people in Palestine, it's quite striking. Even then, when you look at, and there have been some good stories, some empathetic stories about individuals, families in Palestine, it is what Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky have described as victims without victimizers. So the indirection is what's conveyed in terms of Israeli culpability. Yes, Israel clearly drops the bombs. U.S. media coverage is sometimes critical of them doing it, but the benefit of the doubt is often given, routinely given, that, well, it's not that they're intentionally killing the Palestinian civilians, but they're being really careless. They're engaged in disregard and being sloppy about it, not really taking the kind of care that they should. And even less culpability is ascribed to Washington. And it's rarely talked about in U.S. media that this slaughter going on in Gaza would be really impossible without the U.S. arms shipments and the pipeline that continues. And I've thought a lot about the continuity of propaganda assumptions, which are often the most pernicious. And I could mention just a few really quickly, where the pattern set after 9/11 with the so-called war on terror have really been very entrenched in terms of U.S. media and politics with what Israel is doing in Gaza and how the media and political power structures in the United States really evade, elide, dodge the U.S. role in what really is a genocide. For instance, the mainstream discourse really avoids voices that condemn the U.S. government for its role. The U.S. allies usually just bypass accountability for the high-tech atrocities committed from the air And that's a key point, because somehow we're acculturated. If the U.S. or U.S. ally kills people from high in the air, you know, we're above it all. It's maybe unfortunate mistakes are made. It can be criticized, but it's not really crude and barbarian like those who don't have high-tech missiles to inflict their atrocities, usually, frankly, on a smaller scale than what the high-tech Israeli military or U.S. military are doing. And the civilian deaths in Gaza are just portrayed as unintended, which again is really emblematic of how the U.S. media have portrayed the killing that the U.S. government has been engaged in ever since October 2001 with the invasion of Afghanistan, and sometimes not visible to U.S. media at all, the ongoing war on terror that continues to this day.
You're listening to Norman Solomon on War and the Media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. Israel has banned journalists from Gaza. Al Jazeera has been banned from reporting altogether from Israel and the occupied territories. Where are the words of protest from the icons of the liberal press, such as David Ignatius, Thomas Friedman, David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, and others? Where is CNN's Wolf Blitzer, who has a daily Situation Room program on CNN? And by the way, he once worked for AIPAC. Or Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic and host of PBS's Washington Week, who actually served in the Israeli army.
Yeah, the double standard is just so extreme, where when some enemy state imprisons or kills journalists, there are howls of outrage from U.S. mainstream media, as there should be. But we don't hear anywhere near that kind of outrage when, in the case of Israel, well documented, the Israeli government intentionally targets and kills journalists. And that has been really in play in Gaza, where well over 100 journalists have been killed by Israel since October 7, 2023. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, based in New York, which is very much a mainstream institution, has said point blank that Israel has been killing journalists intentionally. And when you think about it, when crimes are being committed by the Israeli government, of course the Israeli government wants to close the eyes of the world. That could document, could portray, could convey what's really going on.
Talk more about war and the media. And I'm thinking of the robotic mantra that is repeated endlessly. The war started on October 7th. Most recently, I've heard it on Morning Edition from National Public Radio. Andrea Mitchell, being interviewed by Dana Bash on CNN, said the same thing. The war started on October 7th. So there's no history. There's no context. There's no background.
History begins when we say it began. That's really the underlying precept. We get to say when meaningful events started. And in this case, when 700,000 Palestinian people were expelled from their homes, from their villages, from their homeland in 1948 with the creation of Israel, that doesn't count. When the occupation, illegal since 1967, has gone on in the West Bank, in Gaza, that doesn't count. When the infliction of all kinds of humiliations and violence on Palestinians of all ages in Gaza and West Bank, that doesn't count. And on. So these events are simply faded into the scenery. They don't get registered in the measurements that we are told really matter. And then when a crime is committed against Israelis, as horribly happened on October 7th, then this is the starting point, we're told. It all began here. And that's just ridiculous. That's not how history happens. That's not how individual lives happen, let alone the lives of individual societies and governments and so forth. So it's a propaganda technique that sort of, so to speak, waves the bloody shirt. It focuses empathy at certain points. The rhetoric of the time, this is an inflection point. How is the inflection point defined? It's defined the way those in power use it. And I go back to the use of words, which is really very important. George Orwell said that words, manipulative words, they don't cause us to have sloppy and erroneous thoughts, but they make it easier. And going back to how the major media outlets, as we cited statistically, using the word slaughter 60-1 to say that Israeli lives matter so much more than Palestinian lives, it reminds me of something. And David, I sometimes think even more than any other ideology, it is Lewis Carrollism that I think is a useful way to evaluate media and politics. In the book Through the Looking Glass, Alice is talking to Humpty Dumpty, and she gets so frustrated by the bluster and double talk from Humpty that she says, the question is, how can you make one word mean so many different things? And Humpty Dumpty replies, the question is, who has the power? That's all.
The hostages that were taken on October 7th have certainly been the focus of a lot of the media coverage. You rarely hear anything about the 11,000 Palestinians being held without charge, some being tortured, sexually abused, and humiliated. I'm not saying that those hostages that Hamas took, should be ignored. Of course not. They should be released and freed. But to not talk about this huge number, 11,000 Palestinians in jails and prisons under terrible conditions, that gets that proverbial free pass again from the media.
That goes to the crying need for a single standard of human rights. And it's right in front of us. You know, on the surface, as we talk about it, it might sound like, oh, that's easy, just have the same yardstick. In practice, it's very difficult because of the crosswinds of biases, of ethnocentric spin, of nationalism, of conscious or unconscious religious chauvinism. And so it has made it easier with these kind of biases for news media and politicians to just ignore. That silence is such a powerful form of propaganda. And it goes to how words are used. What is a hostage? What is a political prisoner? What is torture? By not acknowledging that Israel has a long and accelerating history of torture of thousands and thousands of Palestinians, somehow it's like the precept that's awful, but reigning in Washington, appearance is reality. Silence is therefore not a reality, according to that sort of de facto Orwellian system. I think, too, of words like terrorism and mass media. The media coverage, the political rhetoric in the United States in describing what is going on in Gaza, it's all really stayed away from acknowledging that with a single standard, we could call Israel's actions mass murder. We could call it terrorism. And it's notable that just a few weeks ago, the former CIA and defense secretary, uppercase defense secretary, Leon Panetta, said on a CBS interview that unequivocally, what Israel did with its pager attack in Lebanon was terrorism. He used the word point blank and didn't walk away from it. And that's simply antithetical to U.S. news media, because whether in that instance or the entire war on civilians in Gaza, the unspoken rule has been that you absolutely do not call the Israeli government terrorist. And yet, I think from a single standard, Israel is a terrorist government. it continues to terrorize civilians, 2.2 million of them, in Gaza, and is now also terrorizing people in Lebanon.
Well, with all the attention on Gaza and Lebanon, under the radar is what's happening on the West Bank, where now Palestinian deaths exceed 700. Some of it caused by the Israeli military and some by so-called settlers who kill, maim, and destroy property. They cut down olive trees and burn crop fields, while in some cases the Israeli military is just watching. Now, speaking of language and the vocabulary that we use, would you find it appropriate that settlers should be called colonists and that settlements are in fact colonies?
There's huge documentation, including in Rashid Khalidi's book, The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, that the founders of Israel, and even before Israel was founded, they very frankly, in a lot of their statements, referred to what they wanted was a process of colonization. They knew what they were doing. And despite the mythology and the sloganeering that Israel was going to be for people without land, a place where there were no people in the land, there was conscious awareness by the Zionist leadership that people did live in Palestine and that they would need to be colonized or evicted. There were public claims, I think it was Golda Meir, that Palestinians didn't really exist, and talk about invisibility. I mean, this is, you know, a certain kind of an ultimate arrogance. And so when settlers more and more have been brought in the last few decades, often from the United States, they've been glorified. It's that whole mythology, you know, going back to Paul Newman and the Exodus film in the early 1960s and so forth, that these wonderful people are coming in. They're refugees from anti-Semitism and, of course, from the Holocaust. And so they become these modern-day pioneers who are seen and portrayed as really scratching out of the desert this blooming paradise because of their hard work and their ethic and their spirituality and the rest of it.
Given the magnitude and scale of death and destruction going on in the Middle East, how can we look away? Are we good Germans? I'm reminded of the German Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was part of the anti-Nazi resistance, who was hanged in a concentration camp. He said, I'm quoting, "Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act."
I think it was Bonhoeffer who wrote that to resist repression, to resist evil, if you will, we need community. And I think that's profoundly the case. And in the context of the Middle East, as Americans, we know or should know that the U.S. diplomatic power, military power, and the U.S. Treasury are all supporting genocide through the Israeli government. And we need to name that. We need to acknowledge it. And it's necessary to work with others with a sense of community to organize, because that's really where the change is going to happen. I'm really proud that my colleagues at rootsaction.org are organizing something called Teach-In Network. And we are planning for widespread teach-ins around the country, particularly on college campuses where repression has come down more and more, planning over the summer. Now we're in the middle of the autumn, and many college administrators are fed up with the use of the First Amendment. They don't want encampments. They don't want protests. They don't want their students actually trying to affect history in the present. They want them just to study history in the past, like a museum, like looking at paintings on the wall. And we have, I think, an opportunity, including through the Teach-In Network, which, by the way, is teachinnetwork.org, to say, no, we will engage in thought crimes if it's a thought crime to have solidarity with Palestinian people.
Another mantra that is frequently heard is that Israel has a right to defend itself. How would you respond to that?
Israel does have a right to defend itself. It does not have a right to slaughter children, women, and other civilians on a massive scale in Gaza. It doesn't have a right to engage in ethnic cleansing in Gaza and the West Bank. It doesn't have the right to continue to impose apartheid on Arab citizens inside Israel, as well as those in occupied territories. Israel also does not have a right to endanger the lives of hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East and beyond with this really unhinged militarism. We've seen Israel as the one country in the Middle East that claims for itself and implements for itself the prerogative to bomb and invade one country after another. We've seen that in terms of Israel's attacks on not only Gaza, but on Lebanon, on Syria, on Iran. And it's a attitude that says, we've got the power and might makes right. And they have the power and they have the might largely because of the U.S. government. So this claim, and this has been frankly disgusting coming from the White House, that Uncle Sam is just like a fly on the wall watching what Benjamin Netanyahu does, it's absurd. We have this power as Americans, if we have a democracy, which is not particularly borne out by actual dynamics, but to exert democratic power from the grassroots could be to change the situation. But that requires massive organizing from the grassroots.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says hell is breaking loose in Lebanon, a massive escalation of the violence in that country. Again, civilian deaths in the several thousands already, and bombing of central Beirut, which the BBC's Jeremy Bowen observed. Israel says it's trying to return its citizens to their homes on the northern border with Lebanon. But, Bowen says, the scale of what they are doing suggests more than that. The Israelis will argue very strongly that they're trying to defend themselves, but what their escalation has done is inflame the whole region.
Israel is out of control militarily, and the arrogance is just over the top. Very recently, from the UN, the top official, Guterres, was denied entry into Israel because of his statements of humanitarian concern for what Israel has been doing in Gaza. Rarely mentioned, it's sort of a footnote in a lot of US media coverage, is that Hezbollah has been explicit that it has been shelling Israel because of what's going on in Gaza. And if Israel would stop its continued genocide program in Gaza, if Israel would actually adhere to a ceasefire, then Hezbollah would stop the shelling. Likewise, the Houthis, who've been from Yemen shelling ships in the Red Sea, they also have said, we're doing this in solidarity with the people being slaughtered by Israel in Gaza. Israel stops and we will stop. Meanwhile, we have this sort of spectator role that Americans are encouraged to play as all of this goes on, as this tremendous suffering, this carnage continues in Gaza, in Lebanon, and elsewhere. And when I think of the generations, really, now that have been living under such terrible conditions, even before October 7th, 2023, in Gaza, I really recall the film The Zone of Interest, and the ways in which it's so easy for us as human beings to turn our eyes to pretend we just don't see. When the director of The Zone of Interest accepted an Oscar and spoke out just for 1 minute about how that human tendency that the film depicted of a Nazi commandant turning a blind eye to the extermination in a concentration camp, how that really has its echo in how we can be silent while Americans subsidize genocide in Gaza. The response was outraged and really, in a sense, proved his point. Within about 24 hours, more than 1,000, quote, Jewish creatives in Hollywood signed a letter that just went ballistic. How dare he say this? And in fact, I thought it was a very profoundly important one-minute statement, maybe one of the most important ever made from the Oscar stage in the history of the Academy Awards. We're so encouraged to numb ourselves, to stay asleep, to insulate ourselves from the humanity of others, even if, or especially if, our own government, in our names, with our tax dollars, are making the slaughter possible.
Thomas Pynchon, in his novel Gravity's Rainbow, says, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
Much of the media coverage of what's going on in Gaza simply asks questions that are evasive and avoids questions that would be to the point. When we think about the realities, how often have major media outlets questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken or President Biden and said, how would you feel if your son or daughter was blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers? Why don't you insist that Israel stop bombing or all of the weapons will be cut off? These are basic, logical questions, but when they are avoided, then we're getting this sort of parody of journalism, which is more stenography than anything else.
Leonard Cohen, in his song Anthem, says, ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Where do you see those openings?
Just because there are walls, it doesn't mean that there aren't cracks in the walls. And U.S. news media are certainly extremely powerful, but the cracks do exist in two important ways. One is that there are exceptional media reports in the mainstream, both in news and commentary, and we ought to encourage those, we ought to support those, and we ought to demand that authentic journalism replace the kind of stenography that usually exists for official power. And the other key element is supporting independent media outlets that don't hew to the line of the mainstream militarism, what Dr. King called the madness of militarism. Whether it's alternative radio or Common Dreams or The Intercept or other outlets, these are the lifelines we have to some sort of single standard of human rights and, dare I say it, sanity in a world that often seems sorely lacking in any semblance of sanity. So I think that's really important for us to be realistic, but not fatalistic.
Be realistic, but not fatalistic. The November 5th election, your thoughts?
It's not the election that we want. It's not the election that we deserve. I think when it comes to foreign policy, both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are militarists. They're dangerous. They have a double standard tattooed on their brains, so to speak. And the militarism, the ways in which they are so eager to inflict U.S. military power on the world at the risk of wider wars and even nuclear war, it's truly frightening and needs to be resisted. We need to call out either new president for what they are and organize against their militarism. When it comes to domestic policy, I think it's clear that there are huge differences between the two. And Donald Trump is fascistic, more so than in the last few years, as he has surrounded himself increasingly with people who have an extreme right-wing vision for what they want. They're anti-democratic, lowercase d, and they really don't want anything but corporate military rule while they make war on immigrants, on women, on civil liberties, on a minimal social safety net. And so I think that the choice should be clear as to what people can do. The reality is that we don't get to simply choose what the real options are. It's binary at this point. And so we have a choice to make.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David.
You were just listening to Norman Solomon on War and the Media. Norman Solomon is a political commentator and media critic. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Noam Chomsky, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Norman Solomon on War in the Media, and for his book, War Made Invisible, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.